Welcome to The Fifth Kind TV. Today I'm in conversation with researcher and award-winning author Matt LaCroix. His books include The Stage of Time, The Illusion of Us, and his recent collaboration with Billy Carson, The Epic of Humanity, an international bestseller. This year, Matt is working in Turkey, Spain, Bolivia, and Peru, making a film tracking his quest towards a new understanding of the timeline for humanity. Before we get into today's content, on behalf of The Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability. Get fully protected. Follow the link in the description, sign up and use the promo code FIFTHKIND to receive an 85% discount. Plus, you'll get 4 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content. Last month, I joined Matt and the team in the Van province of Turkey in preparations for filmmaking. Matt, welcome back to The Fifth Kind TV.
Hey, Paul, it's great to be here. I love these conversations, and it's good to talk to you again. We had a pretty amazing adventure just a little while ago, back in early May, when we got to go to some incredible sites and had some amazing experiences together on the ground and really spend, you know, over a week exploring these ancient mysteries of what I'm calling the Ararat civilization and all of the overlaps with, you know, your work through biblical studies and everything was dealing with looking at, you know, Abraham's origins and everything like that. So I'm honored to be back to talk to you again.
Oh, it was a real pleasure being with you, Matt, and the team exploring these sites. You really whetted my appetite for that trip with the conversation we last recorded on The Fifth Kind TV. And my attention was already on that part of the world because of ancient narrative traditions, all pointing to that region of the planet as a key node in the human story. But I wanted to begin with the question of what first attracted your attention to, in particular, the Van province of Turkey. What did you first discover that told you that's a place to go and delve into?
It's been quite a journey since, I think, last August when I came on The Fifth Kind and we were talking about all these sites. And it was interesting because when I had come on there with you, I hadn't even found Ionis yet. And so I had to actually record something to add into that later, because it was like literally, I think it was like a day or two after that, that Ionis came in through research and through other things, and it blew this whole thing open. But I love this question because it's exactly where I am right now writing my new book, which I'm considering one of the great legacies of my time. And the new book I'm writing is called The Missing Key of History, The Lost Ararat Civilization. And I'm in that part right now discussing the timeline and how things progressed to get to where we are, which is such a remarkable journey. It really is. I can't reiterate that enough. Since the beginning to where we are now, it started with this obsession over the ancient origins of the Sumerians and the ancient origins of civilization. Where did they come from? Where did the megalithic civilizations all learn the knowledge of how to build and use specific stones? And where did these tools, the knowledge of how to build or obtain these tools, where did all that come from? There was so many mysteries. But one of the things that I could never get past is, despite the fact that I, of course, am borderline obsessed with ancient megaliths around the world, like Ollanta Tambo or Sasquatchewan in Peru, you know, or Tiwanaku in Bolivia, which are all going to be part of the new documentary and part of the expeditions as we go forward. But the one that I could never get past, that always was something speaking to me, and when I kept researching for years and years and years, was the cuneiform tablets, specifically of the origin stories of the Sumerians. Now, that's actually a great point to really bring up in this, is that when you're looking at who wrote the stories of the Sumerians, it wasn't often just the Sumerians themselves that wrote that. It was often something that carried on in later cultures like the Akkadians and the Assyrians and the third dynasty of Ur and these groups that came in different intervals after. And they would write down or carry on the stories of their ancestors, things that had happened long ago. And so it's often, I think, lost on some that when we're talking about Gilgamesh and he's discussing his time, and then we're talking about, say, Shurupak with Zayasudra, we're coming from a time period that could be thousands of years apart. Thousands.
Yes.
And so we're really looking at an enormous timeline. And that's really where this whole story comes into play. Because as I've talked on The Fifth Kind before and in other shows, it was the excavations in 1931 of Shurupak in Iraq, in southern Iraq, along the Euphrates River, in which they found three distinct layers of civilizations. And I've talked about that before. But the point of that is that the time where we think of Gilgamesh is the time of what they're referring to as Stratum II. And it was a time they're calling the third dynasty of Ur or something in that time period. And that is a completely different time period than the original Sumerians. And so it always came back to me to wonder about what their original story truly was, how far back it went, and what we could separate from myth and legend into truth. And that's really what a lot of my work was focused on, was studying the earliest accounts of these civilizations, things like the Sumerian King List and the Uruk List of Kings and Sages. What happened to these lineage of kings that had long reigns that just mysteriously disappeared with a flood? And then all of a sudden, the timeline of their ages and their reigns is very, very diminished. You know, what happened to those ancient people? And how much of that story is true? How far back does it go? You know, if like the Atrahasis is true and Zayasudra and his family landed in the Ararat Mountains, what happened to them? And that is where my story in this, in exploring and really obsessing about this, really was stuck for years and years. I think I was in that point, Paul, and you might know because we did a lot of shows together, for something like 5 years. I was kind of circling around. I talk about different cities. Okay, well, you know, we know Uruk is real and Ur is real and Eridu is real and Shurupak, because they found them all. And we would talk about them and all the connections and what's going on in Eridu. But the problem was merging those timelines. Like, what? Where did they go? How old is it? Is it, you know, 8,000, 10,000, 12,000, or is it even older? And that's where all of this really began, with a very random interaction with studying online to seeing photographs and archaeological digs out of the Lake Van province of Turkey. And it was there that it caught my eye very, very immediately, was the type of polygonal walls and the building style of that civilization. Because if you look all around a lot of other areas, especially the Urartu civilization, they were building with more simplistic things. You know, you had a lot of mud brick, you had a lot of crude stone. And so this really caught my attention. And I remember asking the original question to other friends and colleagues, and you as well, is how could a civilization with that kind of sophistication with building, polygonal building with blocks, large blocks, how could they just come out of nowhere? There was more to the story than that. And that part of the story of having more is what led to Shabus Tepe and then the lineages of King Haik or Haikaberg with Haldi and this whole mysterious Zayasudra connection that then it blossomed into a whole, you know, I would say, a career change and a life change for me, with realizing that Ionis and Kefkalesi and Shabus Tepe and other sites were truly what I believed going to change, not only change the narrative, but become an origin point to nearly everything that I have been searching for.
The timelines are so fascinating, whether you're looking at the archaeological record or whether you're looking at narrative traditions. And you talk about documents like the Epic of Gilgamesh, where we are reading the oldest written story known to humanity, yeah, and find that it's referring back to even older stories. And then, of course, that happened archaeologically. You mentioned that 1930s mission that very subtly, carefully, tentatively raised the question of how many timelines are we looking at,
yeah,
in this dig?
Yeah,
and exactly. So we went to Turkey with those questions in our mind and asking, well, how does the story of this region relate to those questions regarding the, yeah, timelines of ancient Sumer, the cultures that they remembered, the cultures that they seeded? And I find that whole area absolutely fascinating. In the Bible, yeah, we've got vectors pointing to the Van province in the story of Noah, and of course the ark coming to rest in Ararat, and that's mirrored in the Sumerian stories. We've got the story of Abraham, and in my new book, The Invasion of Eden, I argue Abraham's story begins in, yeah, ancient Armenia.
I agree.
Not in southern Mesopotamia. Greek and Roman writers in the classical period, they look to ancient Armenia as the place where the Iron Age began. And again, that's echoed by the archaeological record that finds the earliest evidence of the Iron Age in what is now modern day Turkey. The Norse stories written, yeah, in the 1200s by Snorri Sturluson, they point to Aslan, ancient Armenia, the place where the Aesir came from, and their counterparts, the Vanir.
Yeah.
Which, oh gosh, that word sounds familiar, doesn't it? So there are lots of reasons to think there's something going on here, that this is a truly significant and ancient part of the world, that there are nodes in the deep story of humanity that belong in this part of the planet. And yet the conventional story is that the Urartu civilization, the Urartians, were the first people to occupy this very fertile region. Yeah. Now it is. It's part of the Fertile Crescent. It's a beautiful place to live if you're wanting to farm. And of course, the first farming happens in this part of the world as well, according to our current academic understanding. How probable is it that nobody lived there or built anything before the first millennium BCE? And I wondered, what were the first evidences you stumbled across to suggest that part of the world has a much longer story than that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Paul. And I love all the connections you brought back to that region. It's not like this is a speculative theory that has nothing supporting it. This really, like you're saying, the origin points of ancient Armenia, Lake Van, that region of the world has so many things pointing back to it. So many vectors, as you say, that link back to something. So it really makes a lot of sense. And when you start explaining it, I think it's an overwhelming, from at least a lot of people I talk to, they're like, that really, that connects. That's like a lot of those things really make sense. And I would love to go through a lot of them right now, because the first thing we need to establish here is that the mainstream archaeologists, the Anatolian civilizations and pre-Anatolian civilization archaeologists, are very, very much suited in their theories and their theses regarding the origin points of that region being the Urartu civilization, or as you said, the Urartians. Now, what we're doing all now with all of these discussions and all of these expeditions, and like you were obviously a part of and got to see firsthand, is challenging that narrative in a way that's never been done before. This was a previously unknown set of symbols and ruins that were often, in my opinion, misidentified with what they really mean because of the sphere of influence regarding the Urartians or the Urartu culture. Now, in the book I'm writing about right now, if these discoveries of these sites are so important, and I mean, think about it, some of them go back, like for instance, Shavuz Tepe and Kefkalesi were found in the mid to late 1950s, and they were excavated up through the early 1960s. And of course, Ioannis was a part of a different time period. They started excavating in 1989, but didn't find the inner sanctum Haldi temple until well over 20 years later. But why then have few ever heard of them? Well, it gets back to the exact question that you had. If you have an archaeologist that believes it's part of a culture, the Urartu culture, that was somewhat primitive in some ways, for instance, their building style was not highly sophisticated compared to other places in the world. They're very, very clearly established using mostly mud brick, and they would use some crude stone. And we don't really find evidence of that anywhere else in other sites that they are established as. Now, this gets into whether or not this is Urartu, and we can distinguish the difference here, and I can go through it. But the reason why people, again, that haven't really heard of these sites or being that important is through the lens of the Urartu culture, these would not be as grandiose of discoveries as they are the implications of what we're potentially pointing towards, meaning that they would be somewhat easier to go under the radar being, oh, they're just castles and fortresses, which is what they were often referred to as in a military type of dynamic. And having a military lens, because the Urartu people were a war military culture, it subsequently led to nearly every symbol being associated, starting with archaeologists like Bernie and others, being associated with a war symbols and actual war artifacts. Like, for instance, we talked about how it's clearly being shown as a sphere, like the cypress tree and the seeds of knowledge, like the pine cone that we see passed around the world, is being associated with being a lance or a spear. Now, imagine the difference, Paul, if you were saying that this is a war culture, these are lances and spears, and this is none of these symbols that represent divinity or anything. They're just based on ancient temple designs. They're like for castles and fortresses. Imagine the difference with that announcement versus the announcement of this literally one of the most important symbols and motifs around the world we see from all throughout Mesopotamia, but even in like the Olmec culture of Mexico and others, is this pinecone symbol and this tree of life and passing knowledge of that. We see that all around the world. And so imagine the difference now with saying, oh, wait a minute, oops, shoot, that wasn't a lance or a spear. That's part of the pinecone or the passing seeds of knowledge of the tree of life. Then you then subsequently see that he's holding a cup in his hand from the Kef box relief I'm speaking of. And it's potentially one of the first cups or chalices in history, meaning like passing a religious or spiritual doctrine. So then all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute. So what is this then? Why would you have a culture, the Urartu culture, who was focused on very, very different things culturally, be creating these types of things? It doesn't make sense. It's out of context. And that was exactly what archaeologists were not saying but suggesting, is that there was some strange ways in which there was high levels of sophistication in symbols and stonemasonry. And they would talk about that being at some sites, but they would equate it to being a time period for the Urartu where they like shined and they reached, all of a sudden they had this time period where, wow, look at what they achieved. And then I don't know what happened after. That's essentially the consensus that comes out of there. But really, yes, it doesn't make sense, because here's the thing, and we can go over these right now. We find a distinctive difference between this base level of design at all of these temples, especially Ionis, with a high level of basalt or andesite. And that's all they seem to have used. Very precise cut, precise fitted, and never used anything else. Never used mud brick or anything. It's a very defined type of base that seems to have all sort of collapsed at the same level, or been taken away at the same level, maybe by a gigantic wave or something during the Younger Dryas, which is what we're, you know, the hypothesis that we're looking at is. But in each case, Shavuz Tepe, which perhaps had some rebuilding aspects, but especially Ionis, has a base that's extremely different than what's above it. And I would ask this to any archaeologist, is if the Urartu culture was capable of building these beautiful andesite and basalt, then why did they switch to a primitive building design on top? Furthermore, if you have a culture that has a linear escalation of technological sophistication, which is what gradualism teaches us about all cultures, that they start more primitive and they become more advanced as they go along, then why would you all of a sudden at the height of the Urartu culture have them building in primitive ways? It doesn't make sense. And there's other things as well. Like, for instance, why are none of the symbols that we see at Ionis and at Kef Kalesi, why are none of them present on Iron Age tools and Iron Age weaponry? the Urotu left behind enormous amounts of helmets and shields and swords and like different motifs of what they would have on their clothing. They left behind motifs for patterns that they had on walls and designs. And in many cases, they were either incorporating some aspects of the previous ancient, more ancient culture that I'm speaking of, or in some cases, they were just creating their own. I'll give you an example. They changed the god Haldi from this winged celestial being to a war god with, you know, a lance and a spear and like fiery wings. And it becomes something very different. And you're looking at this, you're like, wow, this sounds just like Egypt. It sounds nearly identical to what happened in Egypt with what we think of as the dynastic pharaohs like Khufu and all their great, great legacy of a culture that I believe and many others that built the Great Pyramids and the Sphinx and other places like the Valley Temple, the Osirion, the Serapeum, built these incredible things. And then much, much later, thousands of years later, another culture comes, finds the ruins, finds some knowledge out of it, is able to obtain something from it, but then thinks that they're more grand. And then they take and they almost degrade the sites by putting their own writing in. They alter some things. Like, for instance, we know the Sphinx is likely altered into the head of a pharaoh, which it wasn't. And so that's in very much in a similar lens that I believe happened with this region of Lake Van with the Urartu culture, is that they were from a different time period. Imagine if you had, like the early founding fathers of Freemasons had built out these nice stone obelisks and all these beautiful places. And imagine hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later, or if not thousands, right? You get this, I don't know, some young kind of hip people that are from a different time that are like, I don't care about that stuff. I'm going to build out of this stuff. But these stone things are kind of cool. Let's just keep them there and build around them. To think that those are the same culture with the same mentality would be very difficult to accept. And that seems very, very clear. What we have here is thousands of years later, a culture potentially even influenced from different places. I believe that the Urartu culture was actually based on a branch of connecting to the Akkadians and the Assyrians of further south in Iraq. And it was from a different time period when the consciousness was different. Imagine a time so different. It would be like if you were to take the medieval times and then try to compare it to, say, now in terms of how we think, how we act around each other, how civilized we are. That's very much what I think it was like. But in this case, the Middle Ages, the medieval times would be the Urartu culture. And they would be the ones that would be this more primitive war culture that seems to have wanted to incorporate these things for their grandeur. It actually seemed, and I will say, the Urartu culture seemed very disrespectful in some ways. Whereas it seemed there was a fraction of their culture that wanted to build on top and preserve some of the sites. But the way that they turned symbols into war symbols and they changed around and they turned sites into war sites. Paul, I don't know if you know, but reading through the reports from Ionis, they found Iron Age ruins at the top, right at the top, where they found swords and shields and all kinds of things at Ionis. It was a war military site at one point. So it's not that difficult to see why archaeologists would be saying, oh, that's easy. It's a fortress, Ionis Kolesi, right? And so that's why we're looking at this with a completely different lens, because the two don't make sense from so many parameters. And we didn't even really get into some of the other ones. We can go along, but I want to have you jump in. But it just doesn't really make sense anymore, just like we see in many other places around the world.
So today, when you go to Ionis Kolesi or Chavez Tepe, you will find inscriptions honoring kings from that first millennium BCE, so Rusu the second, Sardaris the second, and they say this site was built in honor of Haldi by the great king Rusu or the great king Sarduri. Yeah. And they're making that claim. This is our site. We built here. But of course, the question is, what was there before? Because these were high places before. These were the locations where any people group living in that region would have built something. And so you're raising the question of, well, what was there before and how developed was the previous site before the Urartians did their building there?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Urartian language written in cuneiform in the region, which I'd love to read all of that and learn all of their stories. Do we know what they said about the past in that region, or were their stories only about themselves?
We definitely know some, and I would agree with you. It's difficult to obtain some of these translations of some of these places. I search online. I'm able to get fragments and bits from different places. Like, give you an example, like you mentioned, Shavuz Tepe mentions, talks about Rus II, but it also is called Heikeberg. So it doesn't really make sense because Heikeberg is supposed to be the one who built it, but then Rus II says he does. And so we have a bit of a problem there, because we're seeing another culture potentially even taking credit for the original building of a site that was likely not even built by them. And I think that's more common than we could understand. Again, going back to Egypt, we see much in the same way, them taking control of existing sites and changing them around for their purpose. Look at the Great Sphinx is a perfect example. Why take something that was already an ancient statue? Why recarve it? Well, maybe you want to show the supremacy of your culture versus the previous. You want to show that you're more grand. Maybe you are at a conscious level in your society where you somehow need to create that grandiosity because you're an empire and that's what it's built on. There are a lot of questions that we have to keep asking about and looking into in a deeper way, because the narrative doesn't make sense. And that the narrative is that we know that the Sumerian tablets discuss how Zaiasudra, who's the Noah mythos character from Christian texts, Hebrew texts, we know that it's described that he landed in the Ararat Mountains. We know that Lake Van is in the same region. We know that the area around the Ararat Mountains would be too difficult to live in. It's too mountainous. It's too difficult to thrive. You can't have agriculture there. It's high elevations. So they would have to go somewhere where you could create a civilization. Well, you can't find anywhere more fertile in that region than Lake Van. With the ancient volcanic soils, it's extremely fertile, and they were able to even do things like growing, potentially producing this the first wine and some of the first types of crops like grapes and a lot of other cheeses and honeys, like you mentioned. It's the land of some amazing things that they could grow. And being there, Paul, if you remember, we were there during springtime, and it was incredibly lush. It was beautiful. There was places that took my breath away. Walking up this long, the levels of wooden planks up to the top of Ionis, being flanked by thousands of flowers and green, just like lush plethora that surrounded you, you really get to see how the energetics of that region and how fertile it once was. And that even brings up the question too about whether or not this is even more arid than it once was, because we're talking about a time period so long ago that it likely had a different climate then than it even does now. But what the thing that we're pointing out, though, is what we're discussing is there's two things to my mind. Either Rus II and some of these other kings are older than we're told, or they had altered these things in for their own purposes to show their grandiosity, because at the end of the day, nothing makes sense to be the Urartu culture. And I'm saying that in a way where we have so many vectors, as you say, that point towards something else going on there. Remember, the tablets end there with stating that something, that knowledge was lowered and Enlil and Enki met on the tops in the Ararat Mountains with Zaiasudra and his family, and we're discussing preserving the seed of mankind, and then we lose a lot of the tablet information and we only find some small bits of information. But clearly, if the Hebrew traditions are correct, Paul, we see bloodlines that were passing from this family in different parts of the world. Like, they were almost doing something similar to like Adapa and the Apkallu and these seven sages of wisdom, with traveling to different points and then creating civilization in a certain image. And what I find fascinating is that look at a place like Ionis. At Ionis, you have these beautiful, beautiful andesite blocks that make up the inner Haldi temple at this site. And on the floor are beautiful, beautiful it's called golden calcite alabaster that makes up primarily this incredible front, the podium at the front right there, the altar, which is just spectacular. And you and I got to go right to that spot and be around it and be very close to it. And I can tell you that that was the most beautiful ancient experience I've ever had in my life, being in there. But the point I'm saying is, when you're looking at those stones, these beautiful, you know, half ton andesite stones, what you see is that the symbols and the motifs carved into them are not primitive by any means. If anything, when you're looking at them, they're so precise that I think they're some of the most precise megalithic cuts anywhere in the world, perhaps besides Pumapunku Tiwanaku. It's like they were laser cut. And I want to give you an example of that. There are places you can see that I've studied very close with high resolution images. And then in the field when we went, I wanted to verify and I got to go look at them. And I'm sure you remember this, where you'd have like a griffin that's seamlessly cut into the stone, this hard, hard andesite stone, literally a 7 on a out of a 10 on the Mohs hardness scale, laser cut right through more than one stone. And so imagine putting these blocks together perfectly without even you can't even put a human hair or a piece of paper between them. Imagine putting these together and somehow having these cut symbols that pass seamlessly between blocks. I've asked masons how to do that, and I've yet to get an answer, as well as a lot of the masons that have been brought down by Brian Forrester and his team. And when they went to Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, they were unable to explain the cuts down there on those stones. And I want to remind anyone who doesn't remember, those stones are also andesite. They're a type of andesite in South America, just like this is a type of andesite at Lake Fawn. So again, the type of precision in these cuts, but also the specific symbols they used, have an origin point that seems to pass around the world, that not only is part of ancient pre-Greek cultures, but part of ancient South American cultures, specifically, like I said, Tiwanaku, Pumapunku in Bolivia, but also, which we're going to be going to explore, Ollantaytambo, and then sites around Ollantaytambo, which are just incredible to see these exact replicas of symbols and the same etched in teachings and doorways all around the world, Mexico and South America, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, India, potentially Cambodia and others as well, is to see these same symbols, the yes. same building style, the same thing traveling around the world. When you study megaliths enough and you know the precision, the difference with the primitive culture that built on top, you know this telltale sign that's left behind. It's like it's a tell. You know, they leave something behind. It's like, look, are you guys going to ask any questions about how we built these or moved them or cut them or did all this? Aren't you going to wonder about how we did that? All right. Or give me another example. At Sacsayhuaman in Peru, there are these like 200, 300 or more ton, like massive granite blocks that have stairways upside down on them. Okay. They're like upside down in the rock. And you can see that all it needs to do is flip this gigantic stone boulder back upright. And then it'll be some part of an ancient temple, right? The stairs will go up and there's some kind of a cutout in it, but it's upside down. And there's not even one. There's like three of them of these. They're like literally mountains of stone. And what that tells us, Paul, is one, these cultures were able to do absolutely incredible things with stone that we can't even really comprehend. Did they heat yes. them and put them in place? How did they cut the symbols? How do they do all of these cuts into stone so hard that we can't comprehend it? How did they do that? And more importantly, why do these sites have such tremendous damage that it couldn't bend from the time period we're told? Like, how did the only thing that makes sense about those stones being upside down is if some kind of tsunami flipped them and tossed them like that, because an earthquake couldn't toss something upside down and do a 180 like that. There's something else going on there, or maybe a combination of both. But the point I'm trying to make is Ioannis and Kefkalesi show the same type of damage, extreme damage from these series of events, as well as this high level of sophistication with their stonework, the types of stones they used, and the symbols they chose that we then find in the same telltale types of megaliths and types of advanced building around the world. So it's not like we have these little tiny things that don't really connect. You see all of these telltale things that are there, and you say to yourself, well, we know that that's not a culture that was here after the Younger Dryas. Because like you know, Paul, and like many others have studied, the Younger Dryas catastrophes, and if whoever doesn't know that when that was, it's around 12,000 years ago, specifically more like 11,600 years ago to as far as 14,500 years ago with the older Dryas. We seem to find these spikes in ice cores in different climatic events that show that extreme things happen on the Earth, extreme enough to be responsible for this kinds of damage. Now, at Kefkalesi, Paul, if you remembered, I counted more than 24 giant basalt stones that were completely melted from some kind of coronal mass ejection plasma event, but also stones upwards of 10 tons that had been thrown and thrust down the mountain, showing us the same telltale signs like we see of a catastrophic set of disasters. And that is how, when we look at all of these things, we say it is so obvious now that this culture was far more ancient than the Urartu culture. And they had a completely different mindset. They had different sophistication and technology. They had a different culture, point blank. Their artistic styles, their motifs, their understanding of consciousness, their understanding of harmonic living. There's no indications that this culture had any war at all. We have not found one symbol from anything that's from that time period in those stones that even looks warlike. It was like war didn't even exist for them. So then it brings up a whole other questions of, well, what was their culture like? What kind of cities did they build? What kind of places were these? What kind of mystical temples and places did they unlock? And is that why we see this diffusion of knowledge around the world with this obsession over temples and building pyramids and building these ascension places that we find around the world?
I'm going to come back to a number of themes you've touched on there. Building cultures, symbology, what is the culture being reflected by that symbology? We started off talking about what stories are carried by the cuneiform of the Urartians. And of course, one of their stories is about their king, Haik.
Yeah.
King Haik takes us far further back in history than the first millennium BCE, because of course, Haik is a close descendant of Japheth, one of the sons of Noah. So that's pushing us much further back than the Urartian timeline. And I wanted to ask you about, you talked about the purposes of these sites, that Urartians frame these sites in an entirely militarized way, but what's the longer story and what was the purpose of these sites before?
Yeah.
And an artifact that we found that really speaks to this is it's what you call an ascension pillar, which is like a solid stone triptych window. And we found those scattered at Chavez Tepe.
Yes.
We had seen representations at the museum. And then when we got there, it was fascinating because it looked like at some stage someone had tried to gather these together as important artifacts and maybe as part of a rebuilding in that place. And the design of those, which is echoed in the design of the what I would call the sanctuaries and others would call the temples, hints at a different purpose for these sites. So speak to that, because I know you were very excited when we found those on site when we went to Chavez Tepe. You'd seen them in photographs, you'd seen them on Google Earth, and all of a sudden we were standing right next to them. So tell us about those and how they speak to the purpose of these sites.
I love that day, Paul. That was that was one of my favorites. And if anybody's watched the Chavez Tepe video that I put out, I literally run to that area because I had known there was at least two there. I didn't know how big they exactly were because the scale of reference was difficult from photographs. And I didn't know if they were still there. And And so I was dying to know, because I knew that that symbol was incredibly important. And if anything, since then, it's only become more and more important in our understanding of it. Now, what's interesting, you called them, it's almost like a window. The one thing is there's no hole at the end. So there is a solid triptych doorway that has levels. It has these intervals of stone. Now, the first thing that's interesting about them is they're enormous. That was the first thing that I was surprised about when I was in the field, is each one weighs over a ton. Which explains, and thank God, that they're not smaller, because they were never stolen or moved or anything like that, which is great. Now, the first thing that we have to obviously point out is that one of them from Shavustepe made it into the Von Museum. Wasn't a recreation. It was one of the original ones, made it in the Von Museum. So obviously we know that they're important. Now, the way that they describe them is they seem to not really know what they are. And to be honest, looking at them right now through our lens, we don't really fully know what they are either. But I want to give my theory and give some information on why I think what they are is that. Now, you gave the name that I'm calling it. For now, unless we can actually find the name, I'm calling them ascension pillars, because what they seem to be, like you were alluding to before, they seem to be a representation of the teachings that are being shown in the Kefkalesi box relief, the teachings of a triptych doorway, but within a single artifact. Now, on the Kef box relief, we see all of these motif symbols all over it that is basically a T. It's a T symbol, but within the center column below the top, in the centerpiece, shows these levels, these levels perpendicular to each other that etched its way in three levels. It's specifically three. Again, like that triptych teaching of three doorways, but it's within a single stone. And on the top has the completion, the T symbol. Now, that symbol becomes fascinating around the world. But the first place to mention is, again, imagine you have the Kef box relief that is an artifact that shows all of these symbols all scattered across it. You and I said we could literally talk about that forever. It's so much in that, and everything seems to have meaning, and it's part of teachings. But imagine having teachings so important to consciousness and divinity, that you create giant multi-ton artifacts to represent it. Because I mean, imagine you have a temple, some ancient place where you're worshiping a higher state, some fertility temple of life, right? We'll call them that, because that seems to be what they are or were.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine creating an artifact that enormous, that represents teachings. How would it be utilized? Would it stand somewhere? Would it be like you were saying, like Ishikli is discussing, as some kind of a window-like feature? Is it part of a statue? We honestly have no idea how it was displayed or how it was shown. When we were there, I was able to find seven of them, with one being still in the museum. And when we talked to one of the experts, he claimed there might have been 12. Now, I can't confirm that to know if there's 12 total. But I can tell you that 9 is a very sacred number to this civilization, because there are depictions at Ionis all over the front of the podium, the front of the altar there, that show these candelabras with these flames, okay? And they represent like the flames of the tree of life. Now, on them are three levels by three by three, making 9. So if you have a teaching of 3, and then you have 3 each to represent it, you get 9. Well, I am just wondering if there are 9 total of those to represent each one of those teachings. That's my theory. Now, that the other individual there, who's a Urartu expert, says he believes there's 12. But when we were walking around the site looking everywhere, we were only able to find 7. And 8 would have been including the one in the museum. And so that would be further exploration to find how many there were. And maybe we'll never truly know. But I like what you brought up with the point of the first thing I want to say is that they were all in one place, which was interesting because it looked like they were being gathered.
Yes.
But the nature of them was they seemed to be kind of scattered on the hillside. Like whatever was happening to organize them had failed, and they were like all strewn around that area.
Yes.
Whatever that means, we don't know. But I want to talk about that symbol specifically. That symbol, if you look at a lot of ancient teachings, like if we look at like cymatics and energy teaching and in the teachings, like we see even like the potentially like the Vitruvian Man with Da Vinci and how he showed three doors, I find it fascinating that that same type of T often represents like a toroidal field of energy, a field of energy that has to do with flowing out through this like completion. And it's very interesting to see how those teachings on kept box relief seem to be all based on reaching these higher states and obtaining balance and oneness. That's what I believe that all the symbols all represent, is this balance and harmony and oneness that one can achieve if they balance the Trinity, the three sides of us, the mind, the body, and the spirit, or the conscience, or the soul, which is what I think the Holy Trinity is originally based on, with the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. These three aspects. And it seems like those teachings are embedded not only there, but in other places in the world. One of them being potentially not only Göbekli Tepe, but one even more and more important, in my opinion, that has been overlooked. And I do think it's more important. I think it's been extremely overlooked and underappreciated, and that is Menorca, Spain. The Menorca, Spain pillars are identical to this symbol we see on the Kef box relief, even to the point where the main base of them has etched levels to it. And it's wild to see that it has that same type of teaching within it. Now, when I was exploring, Paul, the new site that I have not unveiled yet to the world, there's a new site that is basically a mirror of Ionis, a mirror, but it's 425 miles to the northwest, opening up these completely new questions of how enormous this civilization was, where the migration route was going with their knowledge. It shows you that, look, they were on what likely is looking like the original spice trade routes of going towards the Mediterranean, Istanbul, the Mediterranean Sea, and the Black Sea, meaning that it's a strong evidence to show that this civilization became so advanced that they eventually became maritime and traveled around the world. And that's what we're exploring with these symbols, because that T symbol, that ascension symbol, seems to have been slightly modified, but then we find it again in Tiwanaku in Bolivia. And it's like you look at it and they create an extra level, but it's the same design. Now, I want to give an example that's specifically for Tiwanaku. If you look at the sun gate, the gate of the gods, I feel like most people see endless photographs of the front with all the images of Viracocha, right? Holding two condors on each end. And there's a doorway and everyone's like, oh my God, that's amazing. Look at the backside. It may not be as shiny and polished, but what it has, in my opinion, is much more telling. It shows three doorways on the back, not one door. Remember, the front shows one single door. On the back shows three. But not only is it three, but it's three levels within itself on those doors. And the doors have the ascension pillar design, the same design on each of the doors. So then you're like, wow, so this is a symbol that we're seeing literally across the world, with andesite also next to a massive lake over 1,000 feet deep, surrounded by volcanoes. It brings up the question, Paul, is that was the Ararat civilization, were they mimicking and creating like a sister civilization with Tiwanaku, Pumapunku? Because the comparisons are eerie. We even find that like a very similar cross etched in with three levels at Tiwanaku, as well as that ascension design. And not only that, but they took this ziggurat step temple design with the doorways and they turned it into the chicana, which is the version of that stacked on top of each other. And that only becomes more interesting when you compare the fact that the ascension pillars, as I'm calling them, look like they could have been stacked, because one end has points that come up on to make a 3D representation of the levels. And then another one could be stacked on it and be opposites of each other. They could sit on top of each other to form what is like the chicana symbol. So that's where we really get into wondering about what is the ramifications of this? Like, how deep does this go?
there's an aspect to the Ascension Pillars. Well, there are a couple that are really fascinating. One is that T motif, which repeats yes. around the world. The other is the sort of threefold inset, which we find with the Ascension Pillars. We found at the Gateway of Haldi,
yes.
Which is built into this limestone
cliff. That's right, we haven't even talked about that yet. Yeah.
And it's also built into the entrances to the sanctuaries, both at Chavos Tepe and at Ayanas Kalesi.
Yes, yes.
So in the temple context, that threefold inset represents a doorway that people, priests, are going in and out of. The Haldi Gate up the cliff face, well, that's a doorway. Again, there's no hole for it to be a real doorway, but it represents a doorway that Haldi can return through. And then we've got that same motif in the pillars as well, which suggests that there's a meaning associated with that design to do yeah. with doorways or portals. And
right.
I think you're right to relate it to ascension and the idea that it's body, mind, and spirit that's making this journey through this doorway, and a hint at higher knowledge. I think it's all there. So I'm really looking forward to probing all that, finding the correlations in other places. But I want to come back to the building cultures question, because this is absolutely fascinating. And of course, it speaks directly to the question of how many civilizations are we looking at layered on top of one another in this ancient yeah. part of the world.
Yeah.
The conventional explanation, and this, by the way, is a segue to our trip to Ayanas. The conventional explanation is that this was just how the Urartians built, that the bottom of their buildings were really solid,
yes.
built with basalt, with phenomenally precise and advanced civil engineering to get them into place and engineer them so beautifully, one stone to the next, in ways very, very similar to what we find in somewhere like Pumapunku and other sites in South America. What really impacted me was going to the sites, though, and seeing what these building cultures look like next to one another. Now, I've got yeah. some pictures that I've given to Tony that sort of illustrate the conventional explanation. Because if you go to England, you will find buildings that are stone at the bottom and then wattle and daub above. So this is one illustration. So the ground story is built in stone. And then above that, everything is built with sticks and mud. That's what wattle and daub is. And though it looks very solid, that top grand part with all the beams in it is basically sticks and mud. And that's a convention you can find in Britain and in other places. I mean, you can go to North America and find buildings where you've got brick or stone at the bottom, and then you've got weatherboard for the top story. And so the conventional story about what we find in and around Turkey, in and around the Van province is, well, this is something very similar. Stone yes. bases and then mud brick on top. But if you look at some of these, and the first picture was a really good illustration, those blocks of stone are not 1 and 2 ton blocks.
No, they're brick.
And some are, oh, is that a brick one? Because there are, I've got some pictures where it's stone at the bottom and then wattle and daub on the top, and some are brick at the bottom and wattle
yes,
and daub.
Yes, there you go. There's a stone one.
But these materials are actually more in proportion than what we find when
yes.
We go to a place like Ayanas. Because at Ayanas, the blocks at the bottom are 1 and 2 ton blocks.
Yes.
That have been engineered with incredible precision. And then you've got mud bricks on top that haven't even been kiln baked. So they will disintegrate really, really easily. And
yes.
there's a disproportionality between the precision and difficulty of the bottom courses and then what is built on top. And
yeah.
so for me, when I was at the museum, I was thinking, yes, that looks odd. As soon as we got on site and saw the two building media side by side, that's when I began thinking, all right, to me, there's something not quite right about this picture. And is it not possible that what was there before the Urartians was the very developed megalithic materials that we were finding, the very impressive lower courses of walls that we were finding? So the first moment I remember a really big impact was when we went to Aianus and stood by those walls, looked at walls that had absolutely disintegrated, and then stonework at the bottom that could match really anything that you can find around the world.
Exactly. And that, right, that was quite an experience. I remember walking along and looking at even the L cuts that we see in like South America and Peru. There's a very specific type of cut energetically. They seem to be interested in locking them in for maybe purposes of earthquakes or others. But no, you're right. Like the example like Tony has on the screen right now, even though the base is built with some stone and then there's wood on top, the stonework is very crude. It's small. It's got brick and mortar. It's being put together in a very primitive way. And so let's look at the whole lens of the Urartu culture. We know that they're an Iron Age culture. They built everything out of brass and iron. That's what they were building all of their things with. Their capabilities were limited by the fact they're an Iron Age culture. We're not the ones saying that. Academics are the ones saying that they're an Iron Age culture. And yet the question comes up, well, first of all, how would they have ever been able to build these types of precise andesite and basalt stones? Why did they never do it again? If they were able to do it, they never did it ever again. They built at a primitive mud brick. Now, let's consider for a moment excavating Aianus. You can see through some amazing photographs, actually, of where the top layers are at Aianus. And you saw at the lower walls as well as the temple itself. You see the mud brick of the Urartians. It's very clear right below the soil line that it's been so severely eroded that it almost looks like dirt to the untrained eye. If you were to immediately look at it, you're like, wait a minute, is that dirt? No, it's actually mud brick, but it's been so eroded that it literally looks like dirt. And then you look really carefully and you can still make out the bricks. And you're like, oh, so that's mud brick. Well, look at the work below it. It looks like it was done yesterday in some cases. It's perfect. It's some of it doesn't even have any cracks or anything. It's perfectly fitted together. It's got all these incredible symbols that we never see again anywhere else. And so, like you said, it really really brings up the question overwhelmingly about how that confusion could even come to light and how that could happen. And I want to bring up what you said a second ago. You may remember, obviously, after Aianus, we went and stopped at like a Urartu Urartian, like a tourist type of place where they made jewelry and different things like that, right? We stopped in because they had a lot of Urartu actual artifacts and different things in there. So we were walking around, and the first thing that I found remarkable, and I think you were standing right next to me, is that they had recreated the building to look like an Urartu temple. Right, not a temple, we should call it a kolesi, right? They had built this building and they had tried to model it after them in this idea that that's how they built. And so the bottom had what looked like this finely polished basalt, and then it went into like a lighter stone above it. And they were like, well, that's how the Urartu built. And it's amazing because you stare at it and you're like, that doesn't make sense. There's something that's not going on. There's a high level of sophistication at the bottom with symbols and stonemasonry that literally we don't even know how they did it, let alone an Iron Age type of technology. We don't even know how they did it. I would argue that some of the work is so fine, especially at Aianus with some of the symbols that are cut into andesite, that I think that today stonemasons with hand tools would have trouble, if not unable, to recreate what they did. And a good example of that, Paul, is that they recreated Aianus in the Vaughan Museum. And the recreation was okay, but with our level of technology, it was very primitive compared to what the Ararat civilization that I'm calling them seems to have built. So in our modern technology, and one could argue whether or not they had fully funded to do whatever they wanted to do, but still, here we are in this modern age with tools and all this technology, and we can't even recreate what they created at Ionis, potentially all of that time back, let alone the Uritu culture that was an Iron Age culture.
Yes. Now, sticking at Ionis for a moment, when we got up to the top, we entered this precinct area that had the basalt bases in it, and question mark as to what was above those, what the upper courses were. We saw what looked like a sacrificial altar with a runoff. And then there is the, using my church language, the sanctuary, or what some would call the temple part, where there is this beautiful podium in this small room, all encased in alabaster with fabulous designs, facing west. And underneath that whole platform where that is built, we discovered what was a water course. And so there's a question over what is that doing there. We've got the triple inset doorway that suggests that there is something, some kind of a doorway experience that is represented by the room beyond. And then we've got all the symbology in that room. So which of those would you like to speak to, Matt?
Well, I guess the first thing is to mention that there's an, like you said, we saw, and it is known, there actually is some recreations of what they think, or at least the what remains of Ionis. There's some computer renderings that have been done. I have a few of them, and they do show some of the subterranean levels that when I went back and looked at them, and we, of course, could look down and see them. What Paul is referring to is that when we were standing in front of, we've been looking in the inner sanctum to the east because it faces west, there was a hole right below what would have been a very important circular type of area where maybe they had a fire or a tree of life or something. We don't really know. It's speculative right now in archaeological reports. But there was a hole there. We could look down through the hole. And I estimated by using a bright flashlight, because you couldn't even see the bottom, first of all, with bright sunlight. And I, when I was able to kind of really get in there and not lose my phone down the hole, I was able to see that it was likely around 7 to 8 feet deep. So very impressive. And that might not even have been the bottom. That was only some stones that I could see. It really brings up the question of what kind of subterranean aspects did Ionis have? I have actually, Paul, some of the reports that I've read, a professor named Attila has looked into the possibility that they had recreated some kind of a tree of life at the original time for a subterranean reason underneath there. And they don't know, though. They have no idea what exactly the subterranean aspect was. However, we do know, again, going back to the comparisons of Egypt, but also places like Mexico, for instance, underneath Teotihuacan, we know there's an entire subterranean area under the pyramid of Quetzalcoatl, where they found liquid mercury related to potentially Quetzalcoatl and some kind of ritual. So we know that the subterranean world was incredibly important to cultures all around the world, the Egyptians, the ancient pre-Teotihuacan culture, as well as many others. But what exactly those subterranean purposes were are still somewhat unknown. That comes back to the example, I think, of look at something like the Serapeum or the Osirion, this subterranean area that has granite blocks that don't open or have anything in them, that are literally bigger than the entranceways that they can even get down. It's mind-blowing. We don't even know how they did it. And so, like, getting back to Ionis, there are so many questions still about what exactly that temple functioned as. However, we do have a lot of clues based on the symbology that's present there. Definitely a temple related to higher consciousness. The cross symbol seems to be related to oneness with source. We see symbols of the sun related to being a sun temple. And I believe the buttress pillars were related to tracking time, or at least tracking the movements of the sun as it moved around the site. Because the way that the inner sanctum is designed for Ionis is it faces, I believe, almost directly west, or used to face directly west, which is actually, Paul, one of the things that I'm looking at is looking at all of the ways that these inner sanctums face and seeing that they're all off of their, none of them are exactly west or east. It's, yes. Which potentially brings up the question of whether or not literally the Earth's axis or the magnetic poles had been in a different place when these were built. And that's again, something I'm glad that we're talking about now, is that we're seeing that not only at Shavuz Tepe, Ionis, the new site I was describing that's 425 miles away. And unfortunately, we don't have any data for Kefkalesi because the original base is either no longer there or is too far below the ground and they have not reached it yet. But either way, I would expect to find a similar type of temple design at Kef if we were able to find it. But the point is, isn't that interesting that, let's give an example. And I think this is an important point just to hold on for a second. You see the images of what I believe the sun all over Ionis. And then you see Haldi was related to being a sun god. And we see some of the comparisons there. Now, the buttress pillars seem to act as an exact representation of equidistance between each other that form a square around the inner sanctum. And now the final thing is that as the sun moves up over Lake Vaughan, it sets in the west, and this temple site at Ionis, Haldi Temple, faces exactly with the setting sun. So, but it's not exact anymore. It looks like it should have been. And we know that these ancient cultures didn't make mistakes. Everything they did was always mathematically precise and perfect. So the fact that, and I would love if anyone listening to this actually would go on Google Images and look and measure at the exact way that the inner sanctum at Ionis is facing, as well as Shavuz Tepe, which facing from the inner altar area out the door. So it looks like it was very important to them to have the sun come in, Paul, and I love your opinion on this, to come in and come only at a specific time of day, shine into that inner sanctum to hit the altar. And that would have logically for Ionis have happened at the setting sun in the west. Now, again, what's fascinating, though, is that it's no longer perfectly west, what's called true west. It's off. It's tilted, it's just like Shavuz Tepe and these other sites. And so if we were able to measure how much each of them are off by true west or east, we could get an idea of maybe when they were built. Because we could then be able to understand when the Earth had that type of alignment with magnetic or true northwest, east or south. Obviously, they were basing it on cardinal points and on the movements of the sun. And so that's some dating and some interesting things that we could potentially play with. But I thought it was fascinating that when I looked at all of them, Paul, the three out of the four sites, one of them we don't have the base any longer, they were all off. They were all off by a certain amount of increments that looked almost the same. And so more investigation needed, more measurements needed, astronomical measurements. But the point is that we may have temples at Lake Vaughan, like Ionis, that could be some of the oldest, not the oldest in the world. These original sites that go back to the very beginning.
I agree. I think that off-centeredness really does speak to the timeline and to give us another approach to dating these ancient sites. It was very clear that that inner sanctuary was related to purposes around the sun, the fact that it was intended to be aligned directly to the west, and then the symbology inside. I think a lot of it relates to the sun as a symbol of time and eternity. And then the advanced winged beings seem to be curating that in some kind of way, so that they are perceived as the masters of time, you know, the time lords, to use that language, the fixers of destinies. And the language that's used in the symbology of that sanctuary is fascinating because it was clearly all understood by the people who used it.
Yeah,
and the precision of those symbols suggests, and the repetition of the symbols suggests, we're looking at a developed language. So you've got the four-armed cross, six-armed cross, eight-armed cross. You've got the griffin. You've got the tree of life. You've got the eagle. These symbols have a very long life. And it's interesting for me, coming from a background in Christian ministry, to find symbols that have a rich place in Christianity, like the cross and the eagle and the tree of life, and realize, yes, but those symbols are much older. They were already telling stories before that time. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about where this language was developed and how old this language may have been before it emerged sort of in this very sophisticated form at a place like Ayanas.
Yeah, and I think that brings up important questions about whether or not some of that writing is even Urartu writing at all. Because let me give you an example. A lot of people don't know that cuneiform writing is not a language. It's a writing style. So it's just a writing style. It's just wedge designs. But Sumerian is not Akkadian or Assyrian. Okay, they're not. They don't share. They don't share the same language at all. They're just wedge designs. Just like the Urartu culture used wedge designs, but that doesn't mean that it's the original language of the Ararat civilization. It doesn't. Maybe they mimicked it. Maybe they have some things that carried over, which is often the case, but it doesn't mean it's even the same language, which then begs the question of, are we even translating it correctly? And when I've gone through and looked at some of the translations at places like Shavuos Tepe, there was a few little areas that I was like, that doesn't seem to make sense, referencing a place being like a fortress or a castle. It doesn't make sense that it was built for that reason, considering that it was for a fertility tree of life temple. That's literally what it describes it as. But then there was other uses for it maybe later. And I think that those parallels are very much echoed throughout this. But it really shows us that what we're looking at is, like you said, it's symbols that were almost part of a teaching or a language. It was something so well known that they had the same symbols repeat in different sites around Lake Vaughan. If you look at the Kef box relief, you're going to see some of the same symbols on there that you will at Ayanas. They're obviously the same builders, the same architects that built them. And that means that they had very defined meanings. So each symbol meant something or multiple things that were very important, but they had defined meanings. And they were all part of defined teachings, which means that it was being taught and it was understood and it was being shown around the world. Whereas the Urartu culture is just, it's like a mixed match of grabbing some things and not really knowing what they mean and kind of utilizing them for your own superiority as a culture, as a war culture, and saying like, we're going to use these as war gods. Let me give you an example. Teotihuacan and Quetzalcoatl and Kukulcan, the Mayan and the Aztec were using both of those gods as war gods sometimes for battles and other things, but they were never originally war gods at all. We know Kukulcan and Quetzalcoatl were teaching the knowledge of the stars and consciousness. We're just seeing a perversion of those cultures later on with completely different mindsets and conscious levels. And of course, if you look at the climatic period of the Maya and the Aztec, there was some serious climatic events going on with starvation. And I think those cultures were pushed to some very extreme places that they never were intended to be. And I don't even think that they were the same culture at all. And again, it may be just like this Urartu example with the Ararat culture in places like Chichen Itza and Teotihuacan, where we think of as a classical Maya, the classical Aztec or Toltec, or even down in Peru with the Inca. It looks like those were not the original builders or the original culture there at all. And so it'd be counterproductive to try to understand what those places were through that primitive lens. We have to get out of that and separate the primitive lens first and then say, okay, what was this culture trying to say? They clearly were highly developed, highly refined in all the things that they did, the things they left behind. We found gold, pure gold, sun symbols, Paul, at Ayanas, some small types of symbols that were they trinkets? Did they have a currency? We don't know. We've never found that. We never found money. But we found gold that being used that was designed in. We found some other things like golden calcite alabaster. We found other things that were very important to them. Very important to them. But what we don't know is definitively what the original language was if we're translating it wrong because we're looking at Urartian cuneiform and then trying to mix it with potentially what they had left behind in the writings. And again, Ayanas looks like that writing is original. I would not say it's – I don't think the Urartians re-carved all that. Just like at Shavuos Tepe, it looks like original, beautiful writing in the basalt. So if we want to understand this, we need to first figure out if it's the same language, exactly what it says. And then we need to start understanding what the symbols mean, and we can start putting this together. And that is exactly what I'm trying to do with the new book, a great legacy of working with minds like you, Paul, and others to go and try to unlock these mysteries, or at least open up the questions and present all the data to try to have something be explored as we go along as a society, because I truly believe to the bottom of my core that Ioannis and Kef and Shavustepe and some others will become some of the most important ancient sites in the world in the future to be studied.
Ioannis, even as it is today, with no more than three or four courses of blocks on top of one another, is a very beautiful place. And yes, you can feel how special and important and beautiful a place this was when you picture the inner sanctuary lined with alabaster and marble, and the afternoon sun shining down the passageway into that room. It would have been a phenomenon itself to be inside magic. That room.
Yeah.
And that was part of the experience of being in that place. Mm-hmm. By contrast, when we got to Kef Kalesi, you get to the top of that hill to where Kef Kalesi stood, and you just have to stop and ask, what in the world happened here? Because they were very large basalt blocks that had been built with there. There was no evidence of upper courses. There were no real limestone structures that you could see adjacent or touching or on top of. And so you look and you think, well, there was some catastrophe here.
Yeah.
What would it take to have obliterated this site? I mean, this is not the kind of site that later cultures would arrive and loot, running off with 2 and 3 ton blocks of basalt to build their homes with.
And some even bigger than that.
And some even bigger than that. What were your thoughts as we got to Kef Kalesi?
Well, you remember when I brought you down, we were going down the hillside and we went down to that huge, huge block, right? There was this one that just like stood out amongst the rest. It was well over 10 tons. I would imagine it was probably over 20. But that block was hundreds of feet down the hillside from the upper temples. And that those upper temple sites were staggered along the top of the ridge that sort of went up along that. It reminded me almost of like a Machu Picchu, how Machu Picchu is built up along the mountain in that ascends up like that. Now, what's really interesting though, is that when we got to Kef Kalesi, none of the base foundations were left. It was eerie how the same, and we know the same buttress. Let me get explained. There's a buttress design that the buttresses of Ioannis, and as well as some of the design of Shavustepe and some others, there's a type of buttress design that has like four corners. It has four kind of pillars and corners on each end. And I've done comparisons of the Ioannis buttresses with Kef, and they're identical. Identical. They're both built out of basalt, relatively the same size stones, same design, except what's really odd about Kef, there's no base to it. Unlike these other places, it's like only the buttress pillars survived whatever this event was, and everything else was just lost. Now, how do we know that it was that extreme? Well, the Kef box relief is actually called the Ejigevez relief because it was found so far down the hillside that it was technically in the city of Ejigevez, which is way, way down below. It's like literally at the bottom of the mountain on the edge of the lake. Now, that artifact is well over a multi-ton artifact, multi-ton basalt artifact. They made it all the way down there. And we had not known about an even bigger stone. So when Paul and I were there walking around, looking at everything, we walked hundreds of feet down the hill, and there was a single stone there that didn't have a repetition of any other stones. Very interesting, actually. Clearly cut. The top was very, very smooth and polished, but the sides were all broken. But in a way where it was like fracturing had taken place on the sides. It looked like if someone had like tossed a stone and it had been rolling or something like that. Now, on the top of the stone was extreme vitrification on the level I've actually never even seen. And even though there was vitrification on numerous blocks above it, all over the place, it was like a brown melted on the basalt, this one stone had even a more extreme level where it was like glass. It had even turned into what looked like obsidian on the very top, but in this like random burned area. So Paul and I are like, I'm like, Paul, come here. And Paul comes down the hill and we come up and, you know, he puts his hand on and we're looking at this, like literally, if I was to estimate based on the size of that block being basalt, I would say it's at least 50 tons. Thing is absolutely incredible. Now, how did that get hundreds of feet down from the temple, which is actually a flat area up there? It's not like, oops, it like just rolls off. It's a flat area. How could it get that far down the hill like that? But then show signs of extreme events. Again, looks like it had rolled, like being thrown down the hill by what I think was a colossal tsunami full of mud and stone and maybe trees. You know, they don't, obviously it's not just water. We're talking about a wall of debris and a massive wall that seems to have, I believe, come through, because all of the artifacts and the ruins were on a southeast angle, meaning that they'd all been thrown to the southeast. So it means that it had to come from the northwest, west, northwest, to be able to have done that. And what's to our northwest? The Black Sea and the Mediterranean in that area. So it makes sense to me that what we're looking at is catastrophic damage from at least two things. One, a massive, massive tsunami wave, because what else could move stones that big? What else could toss them like that? And then two, we see extreme vitrification evidence, like a plasma event, which is a great segue to talk about a very, very important person who is now a part of this, which I believe that's one of the sites that may very much not only support, but may help prove his work. And the reason I say that is that the man I'm talking about is the legendary geologist Robert Schock, who is the one who broke a lot of this open with John Anthony West with the Sphinx enclosure and the dating of water erosion and all of like changing our understanding of the ancient world. Okay. And so we have Robert Schock, who's full-time a part of this expedition, who is going to be coming and doing an objective analysis of these places to see if they're older, what could have caused the damage, what stone is used, all these various questions that are in place. Now, one of the things I know Robert's very excited about and interested in is to explore Kef Kalesi and Ioannis. I saw evidence as well, and Shavuz Tepe to some degree, but I especially Kef Kalesi, for whether or not it's a prime example of an extreme plasma event. And I mean extreme, because as I had said before to you, Paul, and you had mentioned, is that we see countless evidence of vitrification covering that hillside and even chunks of actual obsidian. And that brings up the question of what could have caused something that extreme, because coronal mass ejection would create a plasma event, which would then be like a supercharged environment where magnetic poles are moving and you're literally getting what potentially are like thousands of lightning strikes that can come through in certain areas of the world. And of course, this is a very high place. Paul remembers this was an adventure. Going into Kef Kalesi was an adventure, hiking up more than 2 miles up on top of this mountain, which was well over 6,000 feet up on top of this range. And it would make a lot of sense that a place like that would be like extremely hit by these plasma events. Number two, all the stone was basalt, which is extremely high in magnetite, which would be interesting how maybe that could attract an event like that to those extreme ends. Now, and the reason I'm saying this is that we're investigating this in a very serious way. And Robert Schock is going to be coming there. Kef Kalesi is being one of them, to see if this is all plasma damage. And if it is, I will say, Paul, of my understanding and study of ancient sites around the world, it looks like some of the best evidence of vitrification plasma that I've ever seen. It was numerous, wasn't it?
Oh, it certainly was. And as you rightly say, we found pieces that were vitrified to glass, as well as burn damage in many places. So what happened there, of course, may not have been a single event, but they were certainly cataclysmic events. And it was what was missing from that hilltop site that was really emphatic. My question coming away was, what is still there but under the hill?
Yes.
It was walking away from Kef Kalesi that I thought, okay, we've got to come back here and we need an archaeologist. We need a geologist.
Yes.
We need LIDAR. We need to really look at what is here and what is missing, because those two things tell us the story of how and when this site came to its end. So yes. This might be a time to mention the team and how it's building together for the movie.
Yes. So we have, of course, Robert Schock, who is a PhD in geology, also has a BS in anthropology, and he has such a legendary amount of experience. And Robert is coming at this in a completely objective way. I am confident that he will find anomalies and things that don't match the traditional story, but that's up to him to find because he's a scientist. And then we have Hans Orheim, or Haas, who is a Swedish archaeologist with over 16 years of experience excavating both Greek sites, Italian sites, as well as in South America. And so we're very excited to have Hans full-time join the team, not just on the expedition, but going everywhere we go to explore and look at these. And as well as we may be working with Brian Forrester in South America and of course, Paul Wallace, you're there, I'm there, and there are others that we're looking into. We have another several people that are very possible to be joining this that have LIDAR capabilities, as well as experts in things like sacred geometry and astrology and connecting these into the more energetic aspects of what they could have been, measuring what it's like, the energy of what a human's like when before and then going into these sites and the differences of, you know, our frequency of our aura fields. Like you can actually see that you can measure the types of energy of a human during with a lot of different spectral types of analysis tools and different things that they have utilized. So the team, the experts and the team keeps growing. And we really are blessed to have people from every walk of life, every expertise that can come at this and really explore this. From what I understand, Paul, nothing like this has ever happened. As far as I'm aware, a documentary has never been made in an expedition ever done with experts from every single angle, truly going at these places and all around the world to connect something where we can potentially finally change this outdated narrative of history, but more importantly, show the origin points of what might be some of the most important symbols of divinity and ascension in humanity. Imagine the implications and the ripple effect of how these sites could change nearly everything we can understand. And that's an exciting time to be here at the precipice of such greatness.
Oh, for sure. So that is the team. What can people look forward to in the movie? And what's the timeline for the movie? When will people be sitting down in cinemas and drinking all this in?
I know people are very excited for this, and we're still ironing out the exact route we take. I can certainly give you the definitive things we know. We have we're going to have a very, very good budget to create this, so it's not going to be low level. It's going to be something beautiful that we use every capability we have to us. For something that's, again, not just walking around talking to experts, but something that touches people's hearts, something that gets to the beauty of the region, the beauty of the ancient cultures, the beauty of what they were trying to leave behind and all that we've forgotten and trying to piece that together and give people a scheduling of how that is. The plan is right now is that the documentary itself will not release before 2024 is over, but will be releasing in 2025. And we will be going for the official filming of, you could say it's the beginning of the filming, but I will say we did film a section of it for Penn Museum that we have. But in terms of being in the field for these ancient sites, the filming begins on October 1st. And we have a much larger team than even had just gone for the scouting research trip, which, of course, you were a part of. And we had an absolutely wonderful, wonderful time. But now we're going to have the full team there that's, you know, doing all of the different study and different observations and analysis. And we're going to be capturing everything on this adventure where we're going to be going to Ionis and Shabustepe and Kef Kalesi and potentially some other sites around Lake Fawn. But specifically another site in Turkey the one that I've been talking about that is quite a distance away, and which also includes the location where the Kef box relief was, which is in Ankara at the Anatolian History Museum. Now, there's one more place on that first expedition I want to mention, and that is an exotic location that we then have to get on a plane and be like, leave Turkey, and that is Menorca, Spain, following that lineage and that ancient route to explore those sites. Now, after we do that initial filming, we're going to be taking a break and coming back, and then we're going back and then filming for the second part of the expedition, the documentary, which is going to be Peru and Bolivia. And that's going to be where the story sort of does a loop and comes back to where it started. And we're going to see a lot of the same symbols, a lot of the same building and techniques in South America, and we'll be able to show and compare all these places and really connect a great legacy and story. But that's not going to be the end of it. Once that documentary comes out and where that's going to be exactly, we'll figure out. We're still ironing all those things out. But after even that, I want to point out, and Paul, of course, can be involved if he wants to be, but we will be doing even further expeditions to all the other locations that have mentions, like Angkor Thom in Cambodia, Medinet Saleh in Saudi Arabia, the Temple of Horus in Edfu, Egypt, and many other locations as well that are part of further explorations for this mystery. And so there's a lot of years to come and a lot of exploration to come. And we hope to eventually have working with the entire scientific community, archaeologists too, after we do LIDAR, which we're hoping to do on the documentary. If we're hoping to do LIDAR, and if we can, the next step in future expeditions will be doing actual excavations, working with archaeologists to see what else is there. I mean, like you said, Paul, walking away from Kef Kalesi was it was an exciting but sombering moment because I didn't want to leave. It was so beautiful up there. And of course, we mentioned about lightning strikes, and there we had incoming storms coming in.
So yes,
we had
that's right.
Summit, and we were like, we were thinking about the parallels there. But still, having left those sites and having so much potentially beneath the ground that answers so many secrets and unlocks so many mysteries, it's very exciting to me. I would imagine that there's remarkable amount that still remains at all of these locations, including Shavuz Tepe, that we still don't fully understand.
It's so exciting seeing this film shape up. It's very exciting to be a part of it. I hope we've really whetted people's appetite for what's to come in the months ahead. And in the meanwhile, Matt, let people know how we can keep up with your work.
Thanks, Paul. Please check out thestageoftime.com that I continuously update with new team members, which we may have a couple new ones joining soon, so get ready for that. And we have all the team roster there. We have the mission statement and all the information and news updates as we go along. So if you want to know the most cutting-edge new news things, make sure you visit that as much as you can, because there's a new section at the beginning where I post all kinds of updates and things like that. Please check me out at Patreon and Matthew LaCroix for exclusive pictures and videos from our trips, as well as on YouTube at Matthew LaCroix and The Stage of Time on Instagram, where we're covering all of these expeditions and updates and trips that we're doing. And again, look for, if you haven't read yet or checked out, please check out The Epic of Humanity, which is the most recent book that I wrote with Billy Carson, which has got amazing ancient tablets and readings and putting together our lost timeline. And of course, as I mentioned, I'm deep in the middle of my new book called The Missing Key of History, which I don't know how long it's going to take me. I'm trying not to rush it, but I'm making it what I hope is the best work that I've ever done. And so I'm thoroughly enjoying writing again in that very kind of passionate sort of, you're all in and you're in the middle of a story and you're thinking about it while you sleep. I'm in the middle of that right now. So I'm excited to eventually reveal that book to the world.
Matt, it's always great to talk with you. I'm looking forward to this new book when it comes out. And for the moment, I'll just say thank you so much for joining us once again and keeping us up to the minute with your work here on the Fifth Kind TV.
Thank you so much, Paul, and thank you, Fifth Kind, and to everyone listening. I appreciate all the support. And Paul, I'm really excited for all the adventures that are to come.
Oh, for sure.
If you enjoy our content here on Fifth Kind TV and would like to support our work, please would you consider subscribing to our new website, fifthkind.tv. Here we will have our full catalog of material, along with exclusive access to interviews and documentary content. Sign up today, become part of the community, become part of the conversation. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you there.